Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened the credit and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened the credit and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word is
any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussy-footing, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfucker, upmade me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix. A suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Shelf himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness ever since the Declaration of Independence. We've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence that goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years they've fed you this foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, and joined in the studio today, I'm joined by two of Your World News correspondents, field correspondents, Sankar Kasanji and Tim Bonoff Lynchin. And, you know, once in a while we have a special program, a show that's dedicated to a topic. You know, sometimes I don't think it's so much outside of the beaten path, but, you know, usually we have guests on that enlighten us around specific news and information and issues that are either being suppressed or being obfuscated by not just the mainstream media in the U.S., but throughout the West, and as well as mainstream outlets, educational outlets, and as well as the U.S. government itself. But once in a while, as we did a couple weeks ago, we did our special, The Often Untold History of Hip-Hop, Part 1. You know, there will be a Part 2 somewhere in the near future. But, you know, today is no different. You know, we are going to be doing a special show, a special program, a themed program, and today's program is based around, I mean, it's entitled the Historic Brutality of White Racism and White Supremacy. And you know, why do we feel it was important to do a show like this? Because oftentimes, yes, you know, those folks that have been listening to Your World News have been faithful listeners and know that we have done shows where we've brought on scholars like Dr. Charles Finch, who is one of the leading African scholars, you know, out there, that, you know, scholars in African history, and his work speaks for itself. And, you know, having him come on to lift up the veil, exposing the brilliant history that is often marginalized and suppressed, you know, regarding the brilliant history of African people throughout the diaspora, but the long, long brilliant history of African people, you know, our role in bringing about monotheism, religion, sciences, mathematics, some of the first universities were within the continent, all that brilliant history. So we understand that the history of African people and the history of people of color in general, especially here in the U.S., is oftentimes suppressed. It is suppressed, and everything is placed, you know, around, you know, this mythological sun, and that sun being a Eurocentric perspective of the world, and everything is supposed to revolve around that, as if everything emanated from white people and white culture and European culture and so forth, which is really kind of the opposite, because we should know that biology tells us, science tells us, that the original people of this earth were black people, black man, the black woman. As a matter of fact, the original Europeans were black, the Grimaldi man, Grimaldi woman. My point being is that we have a long history on Your World News of bringing to the fore this important history that is being suppressed. We certainly do not fall into the United States approach to education, historical education, when it has to do with people of color, African people, where they love to start off with chattel slavery. And I will be the first to say that the history of chattel slavery must never, ever, ever be forgotten. And yes, it must be taught so that it does not become current history, even though various aspects of that history, you know, reside in contemporary times, looking at the prison industrial complex being a modern day form of slavery. But it must be taught, just like Jewish parents tell their kids, these Hebrew schools tell their kids routinely, never forget, never forget. But somehow, when it comes to African people, we're supposed to forget the horrific long hundreds and hundreds of years history of chattel slavery and European oppression of black people, of people of color. We're supposed to forget that and not connect the dots. And so that's why we're doing this show. It's not to just take that approach and say, hey, the U.S. approach, we're going to talk about chattel slavery, and that's it. We're going to start with African people's history, with chattel slavery, and we're going to design it in a fashion to euphemize it, to make it seem that, yeah, it was bad, but, you know, it wasn't so bad that Africans were resisting or completely, you know, abhorred that terrible institution, that terrible history known as chattel slavery. They don't tell you about the insurrections. They don't tell you about the Denmark Vesey's and the Nat Turner's, the Stoner Rebellions, and so forth, that Africans were resisting every step of the way, not just here within the U.S., but throughout the Americas, whether it was the Republic of Palmares within Brazil, whether it was, you know, whether it was the Cimarroons or the Maroons resisting and creating their own nations within, you know, lands that had been plundered and invaded by Europeans. That's not how European Americans teach Black history, African history. They make it seem that there we were the happy Negroes, happy Black folks. That yeah, we just kind of endured, and Christianity just kind of helped us get through the hard times. Because yes, the Almighty Bible says that, you know, that, you know, white folks said, hey, if you just buckle up, you just, you know, if you just, you know, grin and bear it, you know, for your time on this earth, you will, you know, on the other side, everything will be much better, you know, on the other side. The other side being, you take that stairway all the way to heaven, the afterlife. That is not the approach we're taking with this. We are bringing up the brutal history of, yes, shadow slavery under the rubric, under the umbrella of white supremacy, white racism. We're going to be bringing it up to connect the dots. This is where the period is erased and we put a comma, because the Euro-American way of teaching the history of African slavery, shadow slavery, it was, you know, it was a tough time, but, you know, African people got through it and they put a period there, not for a second connecting the plight that Africans in America face today has any kind of connection to 400 plus years of wretched brutality, shadow slavery, Jim Crow, you name it. So we're actually putting a comma there. We're going to connect the dots to that. We're going to connect the dots actually to all people of color who have been oppressed by white supremacy, white racism. We're going to connect the dots. We're going to be talking about our Tasmanian brothers and sisters who are pretty much damn near completely eviscerated off of the face of the earth in Tasmania. We're going to be talking about our brothers and sisters in Australia who continue to be oppressed and stuck on, you know, Bantu stands or reservations, if you will, throughout their homeland, you know, Australia. You know, we're going to cover the history of that and how these, you know, these murderous thugs, these fugitives, these, you know, not fugitives, but these outcasts from Western Europe were actually brought to Australia. It was supposed to be some kind of penal colony, and they were let loose, and they literally started just to murder and rape, any Aboriginal that they could get their hands on, and just completely ran roughshod, you know, through that entire nation, which is also doubles up as a continent, right? So we're going to be connecting the dots. We're going to be talking about that in quite deep and effulgent brilliance today. We're going to shed, you know, what I'm saying is we're going to shed a bright, bright light on this history, and quite frankly, it's important because we have to understand that these things that happened play a major role in terms of how these people live today. You look at Aboriginal people in Australia and how they live today and how they live on these reservations that are under-resourced. They're treated like an underclass, and even within that society, they are an underclass. You know, they're pushed to the bottom. And how did this come about? How did this come about? So if we have these dialogues and have these serious dialogues, you know, then we can really start to have some honest conversations about things like reparations, community-wide reparations, having some kind of social justice that is brought about that alleviates the plight, the oppression that their ancestors, folks that are living today, are facing today. And this includes, obviously, also our Native American brothers and sisters and so-called Latinos who are the offspring of indigenous natives throughout the Americas, and so we're going to cover all that today. And so it's my distinct honor to be joined in studio by these two Your World News field correspondents, Sankar and Tim. And we'll start with you, Sankar. If you can, you know, chime in. And what is this show? Because some folks will say, why do you have to say white racism? Why say white racism? And why place this emphasis on white supremacy? And they say it as if it's something of the past, and as if it's some kind of taboo and something that should be, you know, should be shunned. To how dare you attach white in front of racism? How dare you attach white in front of supremacy? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are that understanding, like, the origin of these terms, but particularly the term white, you see that there is no contradiction when you have the two, you know, put the two together, white supremacy. I mean, and in fact, they go hand in hand. So that's one of the things that we're trying to do on the show is expose, first of all, really define, you know, what white supremacy is, because a lot of people have the impression that, you know, white supremacy is, you know, the Ku Klux Klan, or, you know, just like blatantly, like openly, you know, racist practices that were, you know, things of the past, and they don't really make the connection, you know, with that, you know, the international, you know, sickness that's white supremacy that, you know, affects, you know, everybody, not just in the United States, but also abroad. So that's, I mean, that's one of the things we're going to do on this show, is to really show that that white supremacy is not, you know, like this boogeyman, so to speak. It's actual, it's like, as I said, it's a sickness that's responsible for a lot of the dynamics that we see, whether it be, you know, with the prison industrial complex, you know, in the United States, or whether it be with neocolonialism, you know, and on the continent of Africa, or whether it be like the ongoing, you know, proxy wars, you know, fought, perpetuated by, you know, imperialist governments. All of these are manifestations of the subject of our show, which is white supremacy. So we'll be getting into that, and I'm really looking forward to it because I've kind of been in a little break, I guess you can call it. Finishing my degree, but like I said, this would be a really, really eye-opening show. So, Tim, if you could kind of piggyback off of that.
Yeah, I definitely agree with everything that's been said so far, and I think that this is such an important topic because this disease, this infestation, historic and present, of white supremacy has taken millions and millions of lives, and the only way to stop that is to eradicate this disease completely. And to do so, white people primarily have to take the responsibility to eradicate it, since white supremacy originates from the white community. And just for the record, I'm a European myself. I was born in Switzerland. I'll be the first to call out Europeans, white supremacist attacks on Africans and people of color across the globe throughout history and currently. So we'll be talking about the Herero genocide by Germany, which was actually the first genocide of the 20th century, as well as many other manifestations of white supremacy today, and also solutions of how to completely eradicate this disease.
Thank you. Yes, and thank you for folks who are tuning in right now. We really appreciate folks that are tuning in. You know, Brother Kometu, thank you so much for bringing up that you know, that reference point. You know, we have a comrade who's listening online right now who referenced The History of White People. It's a book written by Nell Irvin Painter. Once again, I'm going to put that out there. The name of the book is The History of White People. The History of White People by Nell Irvin Painter. I'm holding it right now myself. I've read it. Very, very instructive. Very, very instructive book. Thank you for reminding me of that. This is a great reference point, you know, for folks that want to take this program, use it as a springboard to really delving even deeper into this topic. Because as the chat room is blowing up right now, people are saying that, you know, it is a topic that cannot be exhausted. I can't agree with you more. It is absolutely a topic that cannot be exhausted because you're right. You said, you know, white people omit various aspects of their own history. So yes, yeah, so they omit. You are damn right when you say they omit that. So when they talk about the likes of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and the like, they omit the fact that these folks were wretched human beings. And I'm going to say that yes, They were wretched human beings to people of color. They owned human beings as chattel. They were slave owners of Africans. All right. That means that they worked African people to death. Worked them to death. I will call it a form of murder. Yes, I am calling George Washington, and of course he was a murderer. He waged war on our Native American brothers and sisters as well. And so, yes, they omit that stuff. Columbus, they omit that. I mean, for God's sake, that's why they is a federal holiday within the U.S. That is a form of white supremacy. It's not always this white skinhead with a swastika painted in the side of his head. White supremacy takes on much, much more nefarious versions, the versions that allow these things to perpetuate themselves by way of having a national extolment of people who are genociders, who are murderers, rapists, mutilators, and that's why there is a federal holiday in the United States of America commemorating, you know, Christopher Columbus, Cristobal Colon, if you will. Who never stepped foot on North America, but where he stepped foot on every other place within the Americas, he brought hell with him. He brought bloody hell with him. The raping of countless women, cutting off the limbs, the hands of young boys, you know, 14, 15, 13 years of age, feeding, you know, elderly men, you know, and the sickly to his hounds, you know, these wild dogs that they had and feeding them alive to them, you know, having their flesh ripped off them and being bit and eaten to death by dogs. Yes, this is the history of Christopher Columbus and his merry band of devils on 2 feet that accompanied him throughout the Americas. And we know this for a fact right now. All you have to do is read Bartholomew de las Casas, the Catholic priest that was accompanying him on this voyage, and as well as Columbus's own words, you know, as he wrote back to Isabella and Ferdinand. So we're gonna cover all of that, yes, and the pre-colonial and colonial whites, you know, yeah, we're gonna get into all of this, and I hope folks call in, and we have a caller right now on line one calling from Denver, Colorado, I think, or somewhere. Within the Colorado region, and caller on line one from Colorado. Did you have a comment or a question, or you want to express your thoughts and views on this topic?
I think it's a good and appropriate topic. I'm not used to having a European address it, which is interesting. I'm going to pay attention and see what happens. It usually doesn't go well, but, you know, I don't know everything. It may go well. I don't know.
But, well, I'm not a European. I'm the host, but we do have somebody in the studio, Tim Bob Lynchon, who is definitely European, and I definitely you know, understand your sentiments. Usually, yeah, the vast majority of the time, having a European address this in any shape, form, or fashion does not bode well, because they find some way to methodically water it down, dilute it, and to bring in their little element of white liberalism and so forth, and we know what that entails. White liberals don't want to have any discussion of institutional racism whatsoever, you know. So
also white supremacy. That liberalism is also white supremacy.
That's right. That's right.
And what's interesting is when we have these public discussions of these issues. And let me say first, I am optimistic that we'll one day get an honest European. You know, every once in a while, you know, every broken clock is right twice a day. Every once in a while, you'll get somebody that just tells the truth. The other parts of the history that are left out make the whole idea hard to understand, and it takes everything out of context. So I think one of the major reasons why we haven't cracked this issue, particularly within our own people and in our own minds, is because the missing pieces of the history have not allowed us to put the puzzle together in an effective way to end it. And I know it's their responsibility as Europeans, because they're the most empowered, according to what Francis Press was saying and Neely Fuller, so they're the most empowered in white supremacy. However, the history proves that they don't have the capacity to actually reverse it. So go ahead.
That's right. Yeah, and Tim, I didn't know if you wanted to address that, because the brother brings up a great point. And before you get offline, I'm gonna have Tim, who is the European in studio. Do you want to address that? Because I think the brother brings up some outstanding points, and none of which I can disagree with.
No, and I completely agree myself. And ever since coming to this country, I've definitely, and even throughout my education, throughout my life, I've realized why your sentiments are the way they are. I've actually met probably 99.9% of the white people I've encountered will not go hard on white supremacy and talk about the brutality and the infestation that is woven into the fabric of not only American society, but European society, and the tens, if not hundreds of millions of lives that have been taken because of white supremacy, because they feel that they can support the Democratic Party today and its imperialist wars against people of color all across the globe that continue even today, and rest assured that they are not themselves racist. They do not believe, they can sleep soundly and fine knowing, thinking that they have, they are morally perfectly sound. But no, that is absolutely not what we're trying to do today. We will go ride hard against white supremacy today and talk about how we can bring this disease to an end completely.
Thank you.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for calling in. Appreciate it. I'm really appreciate the comments and the knowledge and wisdom that caller from Colorado brought in, and just wanted to leave the door wide open. Anyone else that wants to call in, you know, at any point during the show, it's called Your World News, because it is yours, and this is a completely African black controlled outlet. I am the founder of this media outlet, and it will remain as such. And so, you know, anyone that wants to call in, you have complete carte blanche to do so. The call-in number is 347-945-5191. Once again, that's 347-945-5191. And I wanted to, there are a couple people that had some another great input from N2K Knowledge. Wants to tell folks that are listening right now another great book, which I was very remiss in not bringing this up, but The Destruction of the Black Civilization from 2500 BC to 2000 AD by Chancellor Williams III. Great, great book. I agree with those sentiments. That is an important book, to read. So that's another book. I hope people are, once again, that's the Destruction of the Black Civilization from 2500 BC to 2000 AD by Chancellor Williams III. Thank you so much for that. Appreciate that. We have a caller, another caller on line one that I'd like to bring on, and this caller is calling from 678 area code, which I believe is somewhere in Georgia. So I'll bring this caller in on line two from Georgia. You're on.
Hello, yes. This is Patrick, a.k.a. Into Knowledge. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you very much, Into Knowledge.
Yes,
Patrick.
Yes. I'm in the Atlanta metro area. And first of all, first-time caller, great topic. I believe that this is something that in the American public, we dance around this issue, but I want to come at it from a different angle, from a historical standpoint, and this is just my opinion. To me, racism, taking out white racism and white supremacy, just for a moment, racism is a social construct, and basically it is a tool that is used to keep the masses divided. And the way that it works is that as long as you can get people to buy into the idea that there is racism, it's sort of like the Willie Lynch letter, which basically what he said was you create a situation where it will rotate on its own axis. You don't have to do anything. Once you implement it, it's like the Earth rotating around the sun. Unless something happens in the solar system, it's never going to change. And I think that as a general public, what we buy into is this ideology that, okay, white people actually think they're better than black people. Well, I think the converse is true. I think that white people know that they're inferior. So they have to create this element of superiority in order to facilitate what it is that they're trying to do. Now, we all know that the Caucasians are colonists. They go to different regions of the country and they take over. They use religion, they use politics, whatever it takes. Because I'm an animal planet type person. I like watching that on television. And the reason why we always have these shows about animals is because the most studied entity in this world is human beings. And actually, the most studied is blacks. I took a class when I was in college at UC Berkeley called Race and Public Policy. That was when I actually learned how the machine worked, because blacks are used to create policy. They're used to create laws. And with that being said, that I'm not discarding that element of racism and superiority that is pervasive throughout the world. But who's doing it and who's on the receiving end? Because you have just as many white people who, man, they get caught up under this boot as well. It's not just blacks. Yes, it's pervasive with the people of color of this world. However, when you're talking about the elites, and I'm talking about that 1% that controls 50% of the wealth, they could give a damn about color, black, white. It doesn't matter. Like Wu-Tang said, don't nothing move but the money. Cash rules everything around me. Dollar, dollar bill, y'all. That's what it's about. It's economics. Slavery was economics. It wasn't, they just found a group of people who were willing to go along with it. The Indians wouldn't do it. They damn near rubbed them out. Majority of the slave trade, three quarters of the slave trade that came to America went to Brazil. It didn't even come to America. Three quarters of the slave trade went to Brazil. So what we have is we have this entity at the top of the pyramid that is perpetuating this fallacy of, in my mind, that's what it is. It's a fallacy of white supremacy in order to make everything work. It's that old divide and conquer is what it is. And like I said, I'm not discarding white supremacy, white racists. Those are the idiots that feed into it. And then, you know, as blacks, we have to defend ourselves, because if we don't, we just get overrun. So you create a situation where there's just constant going back and forth, all the while the people who are really pulling the strings, like I like to say, the Wizard of Oz, behind the curtain, see, we don't know what's going on behind the curtain. And I'd just like you guys to comment on that. I know I was kind of all over the place, but
right.
I get
that's
emotional
right.
with this.
No, that's all right. Thank you, Patrick. I'll comment on it right now. Thank you so much for calling in. That was Patrick. And Patrick, you know, during the course of the show, if you want to call back in a little bit later as well, I appreciate that. So I, what I would say, and I'll let, you know, Sankar chime in as well, and we have some more callers on the line. Well, I definitely agree to you, you know, and I agree with you to a certain extent, and I understand the, you know, the tenor and direction that you're coming in. And also just wanted to correct folks, it's Chancellor Williams is the, you know, it's 4,500 to 2,000, so it's the destruction of black civilization, 4,500 BC to 2,000 AD. Not sure why I said, you know, 2,500.
BC, but definitely, you know, Google the book. If you don't have the book, go to your library, pick it up, and so forth. So, let me tackle it this way. When we look at, for instance, the organ of capitalism is not an African thing. Capitalism itself, that economic mode is we know that indigenous Africans were practicing communalism. That, you know, it's funny that sometimes it takes, and this is white supremacy in and of itself, it takes a white person to validate what we've been doing for eons. So Karl Marx, you know, comes up with this term socialism. We were living socialism. We didn't need, when you're doing it, you don't need a label on it. We didn't need a label on it. We were living it. The Native Americans, they practice communalism. This is not a secret. They practice communalism. And so, yes, there a lot of different societies had a version of slavery. Yes, the Greeks and Romans had versions of slavery in ancient Greece. You know, folks were enslaved. They could purchase themselves, and this is not a justification in any shape, form, or fashion. Taking somebody and placing them in servitude and against their will, and in bondage against their will, even if they can buy their way out of slavery, it shouldn't happen in any shape, form, or fashion. The European creation of the Atlantic slave trade, chattel slavery, was something that was completely took slavery on a completely another level. It took it to another complete level. And color, the skin color, the color of these Africans' skin was a justification. It was a marker. It was a caste marker, if you will, to justify it. So, yes, you are exactly right, Patrick, that race is a social construct, without a doubt, is a social construct, because we know that Europeans frequently went to the continent of Africa to study from dark-skinned Africans themselves, went to places like University of Sankore in Timbuktu, you know, Luxor, Karnak. They, you know, went to different places and studied from black Africans. We know that a large chunk of European history, Western, you know, for instance, philosophy or Western medicine has its basis. I mean, Hippocrates himself, you know, wrote about the influence that he had, and you know, in terms of looking at medicine from the works of someone that predated him by about 1,000 years, and that was the great Imhotep, who was not only a doctor but was an architect, was a philosopher, and so forth. And so, this what we know as the African Holocaust, which should be called the African Holocaust, the Atlantic slave trade, shadow slavery. It was on a completely different. It was something different, and it wasn't every society that had slaves. It wasn't every society that did that. That's, we know that wasn't every society that did that. But what was done by Europeans was on a completely, completely different level. And when you look at even, and I'll turn over to Sankara in a second. When you look at the whole aspect of you know, money corrupting, you know, elite Africans to do some nefarious things. When you look at even like those, for instance, you know, those countries in Africa today, where, for instance, the late great Sankara, the late Thomas Sankara himself, all right, the man who was behind his murder, you know, Blaise Compaoré, sits in the seat of power in Burkina Faso today. But we also know that it was European and American forces that helped finance, that helped orchestrate that. Because Sankara, Thomas Sankara, a man who was not just attempting to, but was doing some great things for his people, and was saying Africa for the Africans, that we need to produce, we don't need the materials that come out of Africa, we need to manufacture them. We don't need to be sending them to the West to be turned over and then buy a T-shirt made from cotton that coming out of Africa, buy it, you know, 10 times of what, you know, what it's actually worth, and that those material products, you know, those materials came out of Africa themselves. And so he was a threat to the French. Of course he was a threat to the French. And he was a threat, obviously, to the U.S. because if this metastasized and spread throughout other parts of Africa, yes, that's why the great Osage Fort Kwame Nkrumah was a threat to the West. We know that CIA operatives through the USAID helped also orchestrate and finance that coup that prevented him from coming back into his country when he went to the so-called Far East, you know, to try to do some work around bringing some peace with Vietnam. He never came back to his country alive. The next time he came back in his country was in a coffin, and this was after, he was, welcomed, by, Ahmad Sekou Touré. These machinations were orchestrated by European powers, by Euro-American powers. The Patrice Lumumba was killed by the CIA. They got a willing house Negro to do the job in Mobutu, but it was orchestrated. It was done by the CIA. We know this. These are all very, very mighty, important aspects of white supremacy. These are also important aspects of imperialism. When is the last time you can think of a face of color that has been the face of imperialism? Whoops, I shouldn't have said that. We can talk about Barack Obama, who is the face of imperialism. But how did Barack Obama come to power? It was those white liberals and the military-industrial complex that helped bring about, because he was the safe face. He was he had the stamp of approval as the safe Negro of the day, and they helped bring him to power. And it was a brilliant move on their part, that Trojan horse that looks like, some of us. And, yes, we trust him, no matter the fact that this guy waged war on an African nation in Libya, based on some out-and-out lies, just like his predecessor. Obama, as we know, has done 6 times the amount of drone attacks on civilians in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, than did his predecessor, the bumbling idiot George Bush. Barack Obama, yes, is the face of imperialism right now in the globe, or it should be. For those of us that have our mind's eye intact, we know that he is the face, but he is the face also of white supremacy. White supremacy and white imperialists are the ones that have boosted him up and are making sure that they shift and control him. And he's a willing accomplice. He's a willing accomplice. I make no excuses for that man in any shape, form, or fashion. So, I'm going to go to now on line 2. Line 2. Can you hear me? You're on. Can you hear me? Sankar Kasanji, what do you have to say while this person, figures out if they want to talk?
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in. I'll keep my comments brief for the sake of time. But as Solomon was saying, I do agree with what the caller was saying to an extent. We have to understand that capitalism and racism do go hand in hand. But at the same time, I would be very cautious about making that leap and saying that the two are, synonymous. Yes, it's true that, you have this dynamic, with slavery, for example, chattel slavery, that racist ideology is what perpetuated, it was the machine behind it. But at the same time, you cannot separate the element, the central pillar, I would argue, of that belief that, one is inferior or superior in relation to another. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about white supremacy. It's not just or solely, the exploitation in terms of, for economic, reasons, like what you had with, slavery. But, never before the advent of, racism and the social construct that you pointed out, of race, we never had, it's true that the exploitation of humans has always, existed even within the continent of Africa. We had, slavery, but we never had the type of belief that, I have the right to enslave you because my life is of greater, value than yours. And that's what we're talking about, you know, or at least in my definition, we're talking about, you know, supremacy. There's a hierarchy, not just in terms of, like, you know, like, who's controlling the wealth, but also, like, the value of life. So, I mean, that's, like I said, that's just something that I wanted to kind of throw out there. And, like, just looking at, if we look at, you know, like I said, like white supremacy and its manifestation, like, particularly within the continent of Africa, like I said, you had, I mean, like, there's, we know that slavery, you know, existed before, but we talk about, like, in terms of, like I said, white supremacy on the continent of Africa, for example, like, with the genocide, genocide that not much people, many people talk about, one of the first genocides, not in Namibia, but that of in the Congo, you know, where there was, like, you know,
Leopold,
and Africans, I think, decimated the population with it, like, over the course of, you know, a few decades, nearly, you know, 10 million people, you know, killed. And that is something that, you know, like I said, despite that dynamic of, you know, what you want to call it, like, I guess, you know, servitude or whatever, like, whatever slavery as we knew they exist in Africa prior to, you know, colonialism, there's never anything, you know, like the mass type of genocide, you know, that we've seen, you know, time and time and again, you know, not just in the continent of Africa, but also, you know, in other places as well, like the Caribbean, or even in Tasmania, as we'll get into, you know, later on. But that is, you know, that's where white supremacy takes that to another level, as Solomon said.
I appreciate that, and they bring up some really good points, Sankara. You know, bringing up the brutal, I mean, 10 million, you know, Congolese were killed by way of Leopold, you know, the ruler of Belgium, and that's really important. You know, they cut their hands off. They it was all based around on rubber. There's a great documentary out there called, I believe it's called Black Skin, Red, or Black Rubber, or something. I can't remember the title of it, but if you kind of, like, play around with it, I saw it online some years ago, but a really, 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 really detailed documentary on that. And there's, as we know, there's, you know, some really good books out there, you know, that detail that history as well. And we're going to get into so much. My mind is just, like, bouncing all over the place because you brought up so many great points. You know, but, golly, man, there's a lot of things. I wanted to read something. I wanted to go to a soundbite in a moment. But I wanted to read something from the Declaration of Independence because the symbolism itself, I think, is so dangerous, is that, you know, when you have people of color, you know, for instance, celebrating this symbolism, whether it's, you know, and we know the symbolism is a product of mass indoctrination, starting in the earliest ages, you know, of American schooling all the way throughout, you know, colleges, unless there's some kind of intervention along the way to break up that revisionist history that is cake full of lies. You know, you have the 4th of July that's approaching next month, in less than a month, July 4th, and that holiday is what? It's about the commemoration of 1776. It's not a, you know, celebration of today where we are. It is a celebration of the so-called birth of American history. Let's correct that, the birth of Euro-American history. They're not going to say that. 1776, the adoption of the Declaration of Independence, and, you know, some lines, you know, some bullshit, you know, just ridiculous lies that are laden through that. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are that they are endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, let's think about a second. Let's take us back to 1776.
all right, which is what this holiday, the 4th of July, is based around. That holiday, what were Africans doing? What were black people in the U.S. doing at that time? What were the bulk, the vast majority of black people doing at that time? They were still enslaved. They were enslaved, all right? They were enslaved. And by some of these and by some of these frauds who were a part of, you know, the endorsement of this document. Some of these frauds, these white men who held slaves themselves. And so I guess what they're saying is, you know, what they should have had in parentheses or a caveat, a footnote, except if you were a black or except if you were a Native American, right? Because that this bullshit document. Yes, and I said a bullshit document did not apply to people of color. It did not apply to people of color. And so that holiday, you know, running around and you know, wearing your American flag, yeah, it's, you know, the symbolism is powerful. And as you said, you know, Patrick, you know, you put the asterisk, you know, before self and after evident, self-evident, you know, definitely, definitely, definitely. I want to play this. So I can catch my breath, and we can continue with this discussion, and folks continue to call in. I hope that the caller that is presently on line one will, when we come back to you, that you know whatever technical issues you might have, you can we'll be able to hear your voice and your comments or questions. I want to play. This is Malcolm X. this is the great El Haj Malik El Shabazz, I think what his comments here are kind of appropriate for this program.
Imagine the white man telling you and me that Africa is a jungle and everything over there is backwards. And if you go over there, you won't like the living conditions. How are they living over there? Why, we got to fight them over there to get them out. If it's nowhere over there, why don't they get out of there? Why did Lumumba have to fight to get the Belgians out of the Congo? Because the Congo is one of the most beautiful places on this earth. If it wasn't beautiful, the white man wouldn't be there. You got the white man all over there. He's everywhere over there, living like a king. But they're getting ready to send him. Send him. No, it's not a jungle. It's civilized. It's cultured, it's developed, it's intelligent, high moral, high everything, good people, friendly people, hospitable people, brother to a brother. That's how they kidnapped us. We were too hospitable. We saw the old white man coming over the hill, and we accepted him into our city as a friend. And he shipped us down the river, sold us into bondage. This is one of the greatest mistakes that our people made, opening their doors in hospitality to the white man. And when we first saw him coming, we should have sent him then. And we never would have had to catch the hell we've been catching over here in America for the past 400 years. When he came to Africa, he came from the jungle to civilization, because the jungle was in Europe. Savages were in Europe. Cannibals were in Europe. Cannibals weren't in Africa. Cannibals were in Europe. White people were up there eating each other up. They still eat each other up. You've seen these fairies and things running around here. No, they're white people. That's the way they live. They're cannibals. They're savages. They have no morals. A low-down, filthy race. The most filthy race on this earth. They used to live in the caves. They walked on their all fours. They were naked like animals. They couldn't walk upright. They didn't wear clothes. They didn't cook their food. Why, they ate raw meat. They still like their meat raw. Raw! Raw! That's the dog in them, brother. That's the animal in them, brother. No, they're a race of cave dwellers. Didn't know how to bury their dead. For 2,000 years, they lived up in the caves of Europe. And during that time, you and my people were living in luxury, living with high culture, living in a high civilization. Why, Africa is the root of civilization. Africa is the home of civilization. Africa has been civilized a long time. They have all kinds of civilizations in Africa. They have the Egyptian civilization, the Carthaginian civilization, the Mali Empire, the empires of Benin, of Mali, Songhai. Why, you can call out empires all day long from the African continent that were in a high state of culture when these blue-eyed things were crawling around up in Europe, living in huts, eating raw meat. I love to talk about it. Dude, I love to talk about it. Yes, I love to talk about it. Talk about them like a dog. And they should be able to take it. Now they know how we feel. Why, when I was a little boy, they called me nigger so much I thought that was my name. That's all they knew how to call you. Now they get an inkling of how we feel, and the chickens that they sent out there are coming home to roost. They are a race of cave dwellers, raw meat eaters, naked, no clothes wear. That's where they came from. They are not fit to be walking around here telling you to look like they do or imitate them. No, they learn civilization from you. They learn culture from you. They learn how to wear clothes from you. They learn how to cook their food from you. They learn mathematics from you. They learn science from you. Why, the black man in Africa had mastered the arts and sciences way back yonder. He mastered the mathematical sciences, the astronomical sciences, to the extent where he could plot the course of the stars in the universe when this old white blue-eyed thing didn't even know that the earth was round. He just found out the earth was round.
So that was the great Elhaj Malik El Shabazz. And I just having the discussion with Tim and Sankar, you know, some folks might say, oh, man, that's some harsh rhetoric from Malcolm X. Put yourself in Malcolm X's shoes, you know, in the early 60s. Put yourself in his shoes when he is saying those things. He's making a point. Those kind of things, how do you feel, white man, white woman, that I'm, you know, that these kind of verbal attacks are directed to you? How do you feel? How do you feel? How do you feel? Because you clearly don't give a damn, you know what I'm saying, calling us nigger, calling us boy, calling us coon. And on top of that, you clearly don't give a damn killing us right down in the streets, sticking German shepherds on women. You clearly don't give a damn. And so this is, yes, he has anger, yes. But it comes from someplace, yes. And then in between that, he mentions some really important parts of history, that saying you learned this from us. You learned mathematics and sciences from us. When he talks about, you know, and he makes a reference to the Black Plague, the bubonic plague, saying, you know, in making that alluding to the fact that, and this is not made up, you know, Western Europeans, especially in the UK, in London, didn't know things about sanitation. You know what I'm saying? So that whole term, throwing the baby out of the bathwater, and most homes throughout London and the different parts of England and so forth, the oldest, it was hierarchical, the oldest, the man would bathe first, and then the woman, and then the son and daughter, and at the end the baby, and they would all use the same bathwater. They didn't know at the time, like, you know, that you know you're supposed to, you know, to, if you're going to get rid of a body, how to bury it or to burn it. And so they would take, someone would come by come by with a wheelbarrow or with a horse-drawn, you know, buggy, and take the dead bodies and take them and often drop them into the nearest body of water, and that brought about disease and infection to all those who used that body of water. And so I think it's instructive to think about the time and the place when this speech by Malcolm X was given. Somebody else mentioned something online that I kind of want to address, the whole thing about that, you know, that some of the early slaves in what is known as the United States where Europeans were white. Yes, that is the fact. That is a fact. However, how long did that slavery continue to endure for white people in comparison to Africans, in comparison to black people? And on top of that, how long did that legacy of slavery, of indentured servitude, of white people in the United States, how long did that legacy impact them? I would dare to say that if there are living those that are alive today whose ancestors may have been enslaved in the United States, they're not feeling the impact of that today in the same manner, any shape, form, or fashion, the same manner that, for instance, Sankar and myself and people that look like us are feeling that today, black people. People, you know, people that of African ancestry, and so I don't necessarily like, you know, that point within the constructs of a dialogue discussing the impact of white supremacy and white racism and its impact, its historical relevance and connecting it to the impact of in which many Africans, many black people find themselves today. Even right here, just looking at the U.S., the prison industrial complex. The fact that in 2013, let me throw this out here, 2013, for every dollar that a white person pulls in an income, a black person pulls in 58 to 59 cents. When Dr. King was killed in 1968, that was about 54 cents. So that's racial progress. I mean, that's something that obviously the white corporate media is not going to tell you. We're going to tell you here on this show. Other independent media is going to tell you the same. But, you know, every 28 hours in the U.S., we know by the report that Malcolm X Grassroots Movement just put out that every 28 hours in America, in the U.S., I should say, a black person is killed by the police. This happened in 2013. 313 Africans, 313 black people were killed by the police, law enforcement, or white vigilantes in the year 2012. Where is the corporate media? Where is the white media? Where is the liberal media in this discussion? Where are they talking about these issues? They're not. Stop and frisk policies in New York City. We know that 700,000 people were stopped and frisked last year. The year before that was something like 870,000 in 2010, 2011. The vast majority, when I say the vast majority, I'm talking about 92% of the people that were stopped and frisked were black or Latino, people of color. All right, and the vast majority of those people that were stopped and frisked, over 85% of them, were found to be holding no contraband whatsoever. There was that, of the white people that were stopped, there was actually a higher percentage of white people that actually had illegal contraband on them, as opposed to the black people. But the black people were being stopped at a clip that is like that is ridiculous. It is off the charts. Where is that? The prison population. We go to the prison industrial complex, and we talk about 2.5, 2.6 million people in this country are behind bars. The largest prison population in the world, more than China, more than India, two countries that have over a billion people, and the U.S. incarcerates more people by sheer number as well as by per capita, percentage in the world. Right here in the good old U.S. of A., 50% of them, nearly 50% of them are black people. This doesn't even account for our Latino brothers and sisters, but 50% of them are black. You can't tell me that this is not part of part and parcel of the residual effects, the implications that come out of 400 years of sheer oppression, all right? You can't tell me that this has nothing to do with it. You can't tell me that this is not institutional racism. You cannot tell me this is institutional racism when we know that white people use drugs on the same level that black people do. But however, year after year, over 70% of the people, the new drug convictions, specifically looking at cocaine and crack, those people are black. It is because those communities are hyper-police. They are in a perpetual police state, whether it's Detroit, Michigan, Baltimore, Maryland, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles. We know that those communities, Watts, Compton, and so forth, they are hyper-police, healthcare system, medical racism. We know of the great work by Sister Wright, you know, medical apartheid, and the legacy of Europeans, Euro-Americans, even Euro-Americans going to places like Guatemala and doing medical testing, you know what I'm saying, regarding syphilis on Guatemalans. We know that they did it with, you know, the Tuskegee experiment. You know, we know what they did going into Congo, Western whites going into Congo and experimenting on Congolese people. Okay? So let's really understand the scope and the disproportionality. That's like me saying, for instance, that's like me as a man saying that, okay, some men, you know, when we look at domestic violence, some men are beat up by their woman. Yes, that is the truth. But are we really going to have an honest discussion and try to even say that the proportion of men that are getting beat up by their woman, their wife, their significant other, is anything close to what it is for women that are getting beat up and brutalized by men? Are you kidding me? Every 48 seconds in the United States of America, a woman is raped every 48 seconds. Look it up. Google it now if you don't believe me. That means that's 78 rapes per hour. Come on. Let's stick to the topic at hand. All right? Let's stick to the disproportionality and its impact. Sankara, Tim, do you guys want to chime in on anything? Real quick, let me just see, because this person's been on hold for a long time. Caller, line two, can you hear us? Do you have a comment, question, anything? Or are you just listening on? Hello? Okay. All right. So that being said, matter of fact, can you hear us? Guess not. All right.
I'm just listening. Yeah,
we can hear you now.
I'm just listening, bro. I don't have a comment. Oh. I'm just listening.
Okay, that's fine. Just wanted to know. Sankara, you had something to say?
Not particularly. I agree wholeheartedly, and I think it was a very good point that you brought up about, you know, just comparing the two, because I think it's a ridiculous argument to even make that, you know, even to bring that to the table, to compare, you know, suffering is suffering, but to compare, you know, black people's experience, or the quote unquote black people, people of African descent, with that of, you know, Europeans who, you know, were subjected to, you know, right, I mean, to some pretty horrendous behavior, conditions as well, but like nothing, you know, in terms of, you know, the scope, or, you know, and also another thing is like just the longevity of, you know, like the impact that this has had, you know, on people's perception of, you know, quote unquote, so-called black people, people of African descent. You can't make that same, you know, argument. Like I said, if you guys are interested in learning, are interested in learning about that, you know, aspect of history, you know, in terms of, you know, what Europeans, you know, went through, that's one thing. But like I said, like comparing that to what has historically and presently and what's presently happening, you know, to people of African descent now, and just how Africans are perceived, you know, by everyone, even amongst ourselves, you know, and that impact, you know, I don't think that it's even, you know, an argument really worth having. So.
And you bring up something, and another important, because I see on the blog, like somebody, you know, said something regarding, you know, blacks and racism. Well, let me put something out there. If you live in the United States of America, if you live in one of the, you know, 48 continuous states, you know, or Alaska, you know, you live in one of the 48 contiguous states, and Alaska and Hawaii, if you live within the U.S., those 50 states, and we can have a discussion about the acquisition of these states. You know, we could have a discussion about the U.S. being a white settler colony. We can have a discussion about 1898 and how, you know, 1898 marked when, you know, places like Puerto Rico and Hawaii were colonized by whites, and you know, this was not something that was left to like a vote for the inhabitants, the prior inhabitants of Hawaii. But I don't want to get off target. When folks talk about racism and black people in America being racist, black people in America cannot be racist. Oh my God, someone just choked on the sugar cube. Take a second and cough it up, okay? Let me repeat. Black people in America cannot be racist in 2013. Black people in America can be prejudiced. Yes, somebody can hate somebody, say, hey, I want to be full, and just hate somebody based on their skin color. Someone can say, oh, you know, just I hate all such and such, you know, white people, whatever. Yeah, someone can just be that blanketly, prejudicial or in that manner, but they can't be racist because racism is power plus prejudice. Racism is the construct of power plus prejudice. And so you would have to find a predominantly black country and say, oh, okay, well, in that country they can do it. But here in the U.S., black people don't have any political power. We don't have any real economic power. We know this. We know this, okay? We know this. This is why you don't see, you know, I'm not condoning violence in any shape, form, or fashion, and especially not state-sponsored violence. I'm not condoning, you know, police going in and killing anybody, you know what I'm saying, unarmed in any shape, form, or fashion. But we know, when is the last time you heard of black police officers going into, and there being an epidemic of black police officers going into white communities and gunning down, their youth? You're going to rack your, you don't hold your breath trying to come up with the answer. The answer is never, never. Because even they know that they have no power. They know that if they do that, they will bring the electric chair to their house. You know what I'm saying? Black police officer, you dare try to, you know, go and harass and brutalize, you know, white boys and white girls and, you know what I'm saying, young white men and so forth. You know, so we don't have the political power in this country to carry out the institution of racism. We cannot institutionalize racism in this country and direct it towards white people. We cannot. And I, first of all, you know, we shouldn't. I'm against injustice in any shape, form, or fashion, regardless of what the person looks like. That's why I'm against the injustices that are carried out by Barack Obama. I'm against the injustices that have been carried out by Susan Rice and Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice before that, you know. So, but it's a myth. There is no such thing as racism being carried out by black people in this country. In the U.S. in 2013. It's just not the case. And if black people ever get real political power in this country, I would hope that we would not lower ourselves to the same level of, you know what I'm saying, of various segments of the white population who have no problem, who have no qualms doling out racism, you know, and institutionalizing racism targeted towards people of color. I would hope that we would not be, we would not lower ourselves to that inhumane level. I want to play something in regards to stop and frisk. Let's take a look.
The massive industrial strength stop and frisk policies of big cities like New York and Philadelphia must be viewed as part and parcel of urban gentrification, the systematic removal of blacks from the cities. What began as a straightforward intake valve for the 40-year-old national policy of mass black incarceration has evolved into a regimented, calibrated mechanism for adding value to urban land by making city life untenable for young black and brown men. The constant threat of being snatched up by police for no reason within the individual's control on the basis of his profile and the policeman's whim forces thousands of young men and their parents to make a choice. They can exit to a less hostile police environment or stay and risk that life-changing encounter with the criminal justice system from which they may never recover. There is no way to tabulate the impact that stop and frisk has had on the black exodus from New York City. Such decisions are made in the midst of whirlpools of stress in besieged black neighborhoods. But there is ample anecdotal evidence that the relentless pressures of stop and frisk have substantially contributed to the mass exile of blacks from New York. How could it be otherwise? The new year is less than a week old, but already more than 6,000 people have been subjected to stop and frisk, on top of the more than 700,000 or so last year, and the 3 million since 2004, overwhelmingly black and brown men. The last yearly data showed that 132,000 black males between the ages of 16 and 24 were stopped for no good constitutional reason, which was a shocking number to the Community Service Society, since there were only 120,000 black males of that age living in New York City at the time. Police stops of black males in that age group amounted to more than the total population of the entire local demographic cohort. Official New York is saying to these young men and their families, you can leave by way of prison after some fateful run-in with the cops, or you can find some other place to go, but we are going to make it very risky to live here. Two women came to a meeting of Occupy Harlem last month, in rage and in tears at the prospect of losing their sons to the predatory police stop-and-frisk patrols, where literally anything can happen to your child. One of the mothers was in emotional agony. Her son was threatening to leave New York to live with relatives in Atlanta so that his life would no longer be subject to the arbitrary, racist, or corrupt character of whatever policeman was the next to stop him on Harlem streets. The mother was in torment. She loved her teenage son and wanted to keep him by her side, but if he didn't leave for Atlanta, he might be snatched away some sunny afternoon, like the son of the other mother on the stage, who was led away in handcuffs after his last stop and frisk. Should the whole family leave for Atlanta? Back in the day, we called the police an army of occupation in the ghetto. Today, they are an army under orders to make it as difficult and dangerous as possible for black males and their families to continue to occupy their old neighborhoods. There are other people whose presence would be much better for land and housing values. Stop and frisk provides an incentive for a quick racial and economic transition. Harlem without the Harlemites. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
So that was Glenn Ford, you know, adding some much-needed flesh and detail to, you know, what we were just discussing regarding stop and frisk and you know, how institutionally racist that is. And it's great that you know, Your World News is part of a network, you know, and aligned with folks who are, you know, organizing, have been organizing and are trying to fight these racist laws, and props to the folks in New York who have brought up, you know, the case against the city of New York City, and I believe the ACLU is a part of that, you know, and rightfully so. It's a most racist policy that you know, in many occasions does lead to police brutality. So I want to, you know, and may all victims of police brutality, you know, our hearts go out to you and those folks who have lost their lives by way of police brutality. May you rest in peace. Those of the likes of Romali Graham in New York City, Sean Bell, Oscar Grant, Amadou Diallo. I mean, you know, the young 7-year-old girl from Detroit City, Ayanna Stanley Jones. I mean, we can go on. I mean, it's actually so sad that we can. Trey Joyner, that we can, Delonte Rollins in D.C., that we can go on and on and on for a long time naming a virtual list of folks who have been killed by the police, folks who have been killed unarmed by the police. But Tim wanted to say something about education, and I think it's really important that when we look at white supremacists who are shoved down our throats and shoved down the throats of children, black, white, you know, Latino, because you know, racism, you know, yes, you know, Patrick was right on when he said it's a social construct, and you know, white children, you know, that come into this world, they are poisoned with the social arsenic, the social poison from their parents and their grandparents and their forefathers. You know, society teaches them racism. Society teaches them, you know, the myth that, you know, by virtue of their skin color, they must be superior than folks that are darker than them, that have more melanin in them. So it teaches them that, and in the process, it robs them of of humanity. And so you have black kids and white kids and everything in between that learn about, you know, white supremacists. They learn to extol white supremacists, folks that were slave owners, folks that did some really awful things to other human beings. But I think it's ironic and it really has a most damaging impact on kids of color to walk around and to be taught that, you know, Abe Lincoln, when we think about the Emancipation Proclamation, that Abe Lincoln freed us. Abe Lincoln was a white supremacist. Folks listening right now, I believe you know that. Abe Lincoln was a white supremacist. Just type in racist quotes, Abe Lincoln, on the web, and you will get a laundry list of quotes by him. You will learn that Abe Lincoln was very, very much a white supremacist. And that what he did was very much politically motivated, but it's just a damn shame that in connection to the Emancipation Proclamation, that black kids, you know, learn more, you know, are taught to extol Abe Lincoln more than they are to talk or have a discussion about Frederick Douglass and how Frederick Douglass was that great agitator, just as Dr. King was that great agitator to LBJ. Frederick Douglass was that great agitator. All right, folks, look up what Frederick Douglass said in 1852 in Rochester about the 4th of July. Abe Lincoln, Charles Darwin was a white supremacist. You should know what Charles Darwin said about the evolution of human beings, where he placed black people, where he placed people with color in their skin, where he placed them, and his justification for placing them, you know, pegs and pegs and pegs lower than white folks like himself, all right? And we see even, you know, in Australia, there's a city named after him, Darwin. I mean, we can go on and on and on. So, Tim, you know, I think that's a decent segue to perhaps what you were going to, what you wanted to discuss around white supremacy in the educational system.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for that. And I think it's absolutely disgusting to see the United States actually feature these slave owners, these murderers, on currency and build monuments for them in the nation's capital, which is named Washington, District of Columbia. Washington for the slave owner George Washington, and District of Columbia for Columbus, the genocidal rapist who brought so much death and destruction to people of color in the Western Hemisphere. Not only that, but what is it that children have to repeat every single morning before class? The Pledge of Allegiance. And what does it say in the Pledge of Allegiance? It says, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God. And by the way, we're not talking about a black God here. This is, of course, to be understood, a white God. Indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Which means that this lie about liberty and justice for all is forced down children of colors and white children's throats every single day, which is a perfect example of white supremacy and the annihilation of the truth of the current condition of this country and the world from the educational system. There's also no mention of institutional racism or white supremacy in textbooks. It is completely erased out of the history, out of history lessons and just the curriculum in general. the history of resistance of Africans against slavery and oppression is completely erased as well. Whether that's past resistance, such as the hundreds and hundreds of slave rebellions that occurred, or more contemporary resistance, such as the Black Panthers, which in many university textbooks are now labeled as terrorists, which is now labeled as a terrorist organization. And even when some form of resistance is mentioned, such as when Dr. Martin Luther King's name comes up, he is completely reshaped into this teddy bear-like figure who was all about kumbaya, white and black people living together, when in reality, towards the end of his life, he completely rejected the theory of integration by saying that, "I feel like I have led my people into a burning house," and was completely anti-war, and if he was alive today, he would be against the current government 100% for the imperialist wars and the continuing institutional racism that continues. But even when we take it further, when we look at how the great and opulent history of African people and their contributions to the global society has been erased from textbooks, Black people's history in the U.S. educational system starts with slavery. That's where Black kids are taught they come from. They are descendants of slaves, not kings and queens, not great intellectuals, but slaves. Another example, why is affirmative action necessary today? Because of the institutional racism that exists in this society. And as we saw in California, as soon as that was taken away, Black enrollment rates dropped from 10% to 2% in the matter of almost no time whatsoever. When we look at the Supreme Court right now, case Fisher versus Texas, we see that affirmative action is now on the chopping block, because of the white supremacist nature of this country. When we look at the economic racism that affects communities of color in this country as well, we know that people of color, specifically Black people, have been forced into impoverished communities through this economic racism. And then, furthermore, what happens is because the educational system is set up in a way where property taxes affect school funding, they are now funneled into schools that are vastly underfunded, sometimes even labeled dropout factories, to keep this cycle, vicious cycle, going and going and going. And these are just some examples of the viciously racist and white supremacist nature of the educational system in the U.S. There are too many to mention on this show today alone.
Right. So, I mean you're right on. And folks, I know some folks are probably thinking this right now. It's like, you know, some of the solutions around this, like, for instance, with education, these are some things that we can tackle right now. You know, some things that, we can tackle more immediately than others, and other things it's going to take that consistency that trust me, as a community organizer and someone that prides myself in being a community organizer and an activist, I know, you know, the long work that it takes, the consistent dedication that it takes getting out into the streets, organizing folks, and being consistent about that organization to make a dent in some of these social maladies that we find some of our communities, you know, riddled with. But, you know, when Tim's running off, you know, this list of things that are within the educational system, and that itself, you know, there's a vicious attack on Black and brown schools, you know, as we speak. You know, the whole charter school scam, you know, Race to the Top, before that was NCLB by Bush, and now, you know, with Obama and Arne Duncan and with Race to the Top, you know, and they're literally, you know, cutting schools, you know, by the dozens in various cities. Chicago, 54 schools, you know, stand to be, you know, shut down. Here in D.C., they shut down, you know, in 2008, 23. Now they're looking to shut down 15, you know, this coming, you know, calendar year in Washington D.C. All the schools that are under attack are schools that are occupied by Blacks and Latinos, Black and brown, you know, children, all for this, you know, finance capital charter school corporatization of schools. However, when it comes to, like, you know, the education and making sure that the young people that are in our communities, not just our biological kids, but the young people in our communities, are not infected with this poison of extolling and praising folks that, quite frankly, if we were alive, if yours truly, me on the mic right now, was alive, Sankara was across the table from me, was alive, during the time of some of these people that our children are taught to extol, we would be on their plantation. So George Washington, you know, if I was anywhere near his plantation, I would have been snatched up by his folks, and I would be working on his plantation until I die, or until I abscond, or free myself from this world myself. So these folks are not to be called founding fathers by kids of color. You know, you don't call somebody your founding father. I don't think any of us call our father, that somebody that would actually enslave us. So we have a job to do, you know, creating, you know, after-school workshops, going to a local, church or community center or mosque, and asking to have space, you know, reserved there to do after-school workshops, doing workshops, even in street corners, holding forth and organizing the parents and saying, listen, this is why I'm doing this, and getting the support of the parents to really encourage their kids. There's a lot of work that we can do ourselves immediately to break up the monotony that is perpetuated, the monotony of just this indoctrination, this blind indoctrination that is perpetuated by the American school system. You know, so, I think that we constantly have to be thinking of solutions and getting information out there, and on a global scale. You know, we see that there's a war on our, you know, African homeland. There's a war in the global south. I mean, you look at how, you know, folks throughout the global south, whether it's Guatemala, Honduras, you know what I'm saying, and props to our comrades from those countries like Bolivia and Venezuela, you know what I'm saying, Cuba, who have put up a very formidable point of resistance, you know, for us to look at and to actually praise their resistance that they put up to Western imperialism. But I want to also, you know, mention, I mentioned Flinders Island in Tasmania, and Thomas Robinson, who was this white missionary who was assigned to cast off, to go and Christianize and somewhat domesticate indigenous people from Tasmania, put them on this island called Flinders Island, that should be remembered, because those people were killed off, but either by at the hands of British or at the hands of disease that they brought there to Tasmania. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, religion. You know, the religious aspect. Religious aspect. Was it Jomo Kenyatta said, you know, the white man came with a Bible. You know, by the time he left, we had the Bible and he had the land. You know what I'm saying? By the time it was all said and done, we had the Bible and he had the land. The role that European, Christianity itself was imposed upon our people to pacify folks throughout the global south. But we must look at the coups throughout Latin America. We must look at Central America and what was done, Operation Just Cause in the 80s, by way of the U.S. government and George H.W. Bush, you know, killing 3,000 to 4,000 Panamanians, through this thing called Operation Just Cause. When they do these things, think about the last time. When they do these things, 9 times out of 10, these things are done to countries of color. These things are done to countries of color. We look at Maurice Bishop in the 80s, you know, and the New Jewel movement, and how that was seen as a major threat to Reagan and the United States itself. You know, India, exactly, the social Darwinism in India, and what the British did to the people, you know, of India, and how that literally 8 million, you know, Indians were starved to death and worked to death and beat to death. This is really important stuff, and how the British balkanized that chunk of land, and which created Pakistan, you know, in India, you know what I'm saying, in Afghanistan. This is really important stuff. The Berlin Conference of 1884, starting in 1884, ending in 1885, where, you know, these Europeans got together and they said, okay, we're gonna chop up, you know, the African continent. You know, France, you guys are gonna get you know, Senegal, you get the Ivory Coast, you get the, all these countries. Portuguese, you'll get Angola, Mozambique, you know, the Germans, you'll get, you know, Namibia. And we know the first genocide in the 20th century, 1903, 1904, was, you know, the Germans going into Southwest Africa, now known as Namibia, and killing, you know, 85% of the Herero people, as well as many of the Ovambo people. I mean, we literally go on and on and on. South Africa, past and present, the apartheid in South Africa. I mean, we go on and on. Palestinians, you know, what were done to our Palestinian brothers by way of Theodor Herzl's Zionism and what that has done and how that start, you know, took ripped away the land of Palestinians in, you know, 1947, 48. You know, 1967, you know, taking away even more land, and how Palestinians now live in the biggest open-air prison known as the Gaza Strip and the West Bank that continually, perpetually has settlements being popped up here and there. I mean, we can go on and on and on, and that's the sad part about it. That's really the sad thick and thin about it, you know, because apartheid. You look at our brothers and sisters right now in Africa. This is key. You talk about white supremacy. You look at our brothers and sisters in South Africa right now, in Azania. 85 to 87% of the arable land is controlled by the white minority to this day. Okay? So what happened with the Freedom Charter? No, that was a deal that was struck by the elites in the ANC with the whites that were controlling the finance capitalists said, no. Yes, we will allow you to end, you know, apartheid to a certain extent, but the economic apartheid continues to go on, and that's why you know the vast majority of South African, black South Africans, are living in squalor. They're living in squalor. Almost 20 years since the so-called end of apartheid. These discussions must happen. Must be had. They must be had with those of us living here in the West, to let folks understand that what is still going on, that we need to merge these experiences and understanding that there are folks in other parts of the world, not just in Africa, but also in Central America, Latin America, and so forth, Australia, that are going through similar struggles, and we must see that solidarity with them. We must see that solidarity with them, and we must look at and we must embrace that resistance. That resistance to all forms of white supremacy, and then mount that continue to mount that deconstruction of institutional racism as we know it must go on. I think as I said before, thanks Tim for that. But as I said before, Cuba, Venezuela, these are great examples of countries who have put together pretty significant, you know, resistance to white supremacy and neo-colonization, imperialism. You know, you can look at even Zimbabwe and Eritrea as examples as well. So that being said, I want to play, you know, a song. This is a song by an artist by the name of Ross Koss called Nature of the Threat. I want to play this. It's a 7-minute song, but, you know, I want to play this. And on the other end, if Patrick or any other folks want to have any you know, comments as we head towards the last 20 minutes of this program, please type it in the chat room. But this is important history, and if anyone wants these, you know, these reference points, what have you, you know, you can email us offline, you know, at solo SOLO at yourworldnews.org. That's solo SOLO at yourworldnews.org, and give you the reference points, the books, all the points that we bring up, because it's important. It's important to know historically what has been going on, but it also is important to know the mounted resistance that is going on as well, and to look at that, to look at the struggles that are going on with other folks, to see. Don't allow America, don't allow the West to prevent you from seeing solidarity with your brothers and sisters, and to buy into this whole kind of Americanism thing. Well, I'm just American, and I shouldn't care about what's going on in the Congo. I shouldn't care about neocolonization that's going on in the Congo. I shouldn't care about how, you know, 6 to 10 million Congolese have been killed since 1996. I shouldn't care about those things. I shouldn't care how these companies are plundering that land, and you know, I shouldn't care about that. Are you kidding me? It was in Kwame Nkrumah who came to power in 1957. Was not satisfied with him coming to power with Ghana becoming Ghana and the Gold Coast becoming no more. He wasn't satisfied with that. He said, "We are not. The job is not done until all of Africa is liberated, is freed from colonization." And you know, we need to adopt that kind of mentality, that objective of reaching Pan-Africanism. This is Roscoe's Nature of the Threat.
Let freedom ring with a buckshot, but not just yet. First, we need to truly understand the nature of the threat. And a pale man walks in the threshold of darkness. Roughly 20,000 years ago, the first humans evolved with the phenotypical trait, genetic recessive, blue eyes, blonde hair, and white skin. Albinism apparently was a sin to the original man, African, so the mutants traveled north of the equator. Go Europeans later, the first race haters, who is the devil's alpha to the beta? Cause history best qualified to teach one, quoting German philosopher Schopenhauer, every white man is a faded or a bleached one. Migration created further mutation, genetic drifts, evolution through recombination, adapted to the climate, as the Caucasus mountain man reverted to that of a primate. Savage Neanderthals until the late Paleolithic age, as when the black Grimaldi man came with the symbol of the dragon, fire and art. JK paintings in France and Spain to the Venus of Willendorf. Around 2000 BC, southern Russians migrating small units. Those who traveled west populated Europe. Those who went east settled in Iran, known as Aryans. 1500 BC, some crossed the Khyber Pass into India and created Hinduism, the first caste system, the origins of racism. A white dot on the forehead meant to leap. The black dot defeat, untrustable, untouchable. They wrote the Holy Vedas in Sanskrit. That's the language that created Greek, German, Latin, and English. Now the Minoans around 2000 BC starts on the island of Crete in the Aegean Sea. The Greek culture begins Western civilization, but Western civilization means white domination. Mycenaeans learned from Kemet called Egypt and Greek. It existed since at least 3000 BC, creating geometry and astronomy. This knowledge influenced Plato, Socrates, and Hippocrates. Cause Imhotep, the real father of medicine, was worshipped in Greece and Rome in the form of a black African. The word Africa comes from the Greek Afrique, meaning without code. The word philosophy means love of knowledge, stole from the first man. Greek power expands, the first Greek fraternities banned. The word gymnasium is Greek for naked. This was the place where adolescent boys were educated and molested. This was accepted because Greek culture was homosexual. For example, Sappho trained girls on the island of Lesbos. Hence the word lesbian.
Hey, let these dumb motherfuckers know.
December 25th, the birth of Saturn. A homosexual god, I checked the historical pattern. December 25th, now thought the birth of Christ was Saturnalia. When men got drunk, fucked each other, then beat their wife. Fact is, it was still practiced till they called it Christmas. So put a gerbil on your Christmas list. The Hellenistic era, Alexander the Great conquers all the way to India, leaving four successive states. By the 5th century BC, Rome succeeds to be the conqueror of Egypt and Greece, but had the threat of the Black Phoenicians in Sicily. The Punic Wars began 264 BC. The Black General Hannibal and Carthaginian peace. In 146 BC, Carthage fell after a 6-month siege. Rome sold every citizen in slavery, the first genocide of history. And more bisexuality in sight. Julius Caesar was known as every woman's husband and every man's wife. The Spartacus revolt, slave rebellion at loss. With 6,000 slaves was nailed on a cross. Cross, oh shit, Jesus Christ. Time for some act right. Christians, get your facts right. Cause Christ was not his name. That's Greek for one who was anointed. Yahshua ben Yosef was his name. Do Christians know this? So who do you praise? Do you know his name? Or do you do this in vain? Accepting the religion they gave slaves to behave. Peep the description of a story in Josephus. Short, dark, with an underdeveloped beard was Jesus. He had the Roman spear in revolution. The solution was to take him to court and falsely accuse him. After being murdered by Pilate, how can it be these same white Romans established Christianity? Constantine would later see the cross in a dream. In his vision, it read, in half, signal walker. In this night we conquer, manifest destiny. In 325, he convened the Nicene Creed and separated God into three. Decided Jesus was born on December 25th and raising on the third day is a myth. Plus to deceivers. Commissioned Michelangelo to paint white pictures of Jesus. He used his aunt, uncle, and nephew. Subconsciously, that affects you. It makes you put white people closer to God.
Yo. Man got game like a motherfucker.
True indeed, fuck it, jihad. In the 8th century, Muslims conquered Spain, Portugal, and France and controlled it for 700 years. They never mention this in history class, cause those faiths are threatened when you get the real lesson. Moors from Baghdad, Turkey, threaten European Christians, meaning the white way of life. Hence the crusade for Christ. On November 25th, 1491, Santiago defeats the last Muslim stronghold, Granada. King Ferdinand gave thanks to God for victory, and the Pope of Rome declared this day to forever be a day of thanksgiving for all European Christians. Now listen, when you celebrate Thanksgiving, what you are actually celebrating is the proclamation of the Pope of Rome, who later in league with Queen Isabella sent Cardinal Seminole to Spain to murder any black that was Christianity. These Moors, these black men and women, were from Baghdad, Turkey. And today you eat the turkey for your Thanksgiving day as the European powers destroyed the turkey who was your father and your mother and father.
Get on the ground.
Let's fight the power.
Get on the ground.
Bitch ass nigga.
Get down.
Now around this time, whites started calling us Negroes. That's Spanish for black object, meaning we're not really people but property. And the triangle trade begins, they seize us. Queen Elizabeth sent the first slaves on a ship named Jesus. Stealing land from the indigenous natives. Gave them alcohol to keep the red man intoxicated. Whites claimed they had to civilize these pagan animals. But up until 1848, there's documented cases of whites being the savage cannibals. Eating Indians. In 1992, it was Jeffrey Dahmer. They slaughtered a whole race with guns, drugs, priests, and nuns. 1763, the first demonic tactic of biological warfare. As tokens of peace, Sir Jeffrey Amherst passed out clothing and blankets to the Indian community. Infested with smallpox, knowing they had no immunity. Today it's AIDS, you best believe it's man-made. Cause ain't a damn thing changed. Let me explain. Now, since people of color are genetically dominant and Caucasoids are genetically recessive, and whites expect to be predominant, meaning survive as a race, then they simply must take precautions. That's why they're worried about the future now. Cause by 2050, almost all the Earth's population will be browned and black. So understanding that, whites counter-react.
I'm saying, man, the fools ain't nothing but a teaspoon of milk in a world color majority.
So they created a system to force blacks into an unnatural position that reinforces the position of natural inferiority. In addition, creating guns and develop the ethnocentric view that God justifies every fucking thing they do. Condition people to perceive whites' culture as civilized and every other culture considered primitive. Not true. Racism is the system of racial subjugation against non-whites in every area of human relation. Entertainment, education, labor, politics, law, religion, sex, war, and economics. See, blacks were three-fifths of a man with tax purposes intended. You think you're Afro-American, you're a 14th Amendment and a good nigga. Jews don't salute the fucking swastika, but niggas pledge allegiance to the flag that accosted you. They never teach about the breaker islands like Jamaica. But before slaves came here, whites would take a pregnant woman, hang her from a tree by her toes, slice her stomach with a knife and let the unborn baby fall to the floor. They stop an unborn child in front of all the slaves to end breed fear so they'd be scared, behave, and not rebel move. Understand, all whites must be perceived as potential predators. I paraphrase historian Ishaq Musa Bereshenko. Understand that regardless of the lofty ideas engraved on paper, in such documents as the Constitution, a Declaration, the basic nature of the European-American white man remains virtually unchanged. So check. This is the nature of the threat.
And that was... that was the inimitable Ross Kahn's great album. If you like that song, a classic album by his. You can pick up the CD on Amazon. It's actually kind of expensive because it is known as a classic. It's I don't think you can find it less than like $50 or so. But it's a Soul on Ice is the name of that album. I believe it's Soul on Ice. I hope I'm not. Not wrong on that, but you know, just a couple other points. And before I bring Patrick on, and then have Sankara and Tim, you know, give their closing comments. You know, looking at Thanksgiving, he brought up Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving,
if we look at Thanksgiving, the derivation of Thanksgiving, looking at William Bradford, Governor William Bradford, you know, looking at Miles Standish and those folks, and looking at what happened in the 1620s, 1630s, and 1640s, these were complete massacres, bloody massacres that took the lives, brutally took the lives of men, women, children, elderly, Pequot, Narragansett, Wampanoag, you know, Nation people. And, you know, these folks like William Bradford, after these bloody, you know what I'm saying, you know, the likes of William Bradford, these bloody massacres, you know, look to their God, because, you know, whoever their God is that they worship is a completely different God that I'm certain. Their God that they were worshiping is certainly to have be somebody that was red and had horns sticking out of their heads. You know, and said, you know, let this be a day to give thanks. Let this be a day to give thanks, you know. And, let this be a day to give thanks. Let this be a day to give thanks. That is Thanksgiving. So I know it's been something that's been indoctrinated in us, but come that fourth Thursday of the month, you can have the dinner. You don't have to call it Thanksgiving. You can have the dinner and call it Indigenous Peoples Day, or Harvest Day. We're having a Harvest Day celebration, Harvest Day dinner. You don't have to call it Thanksgiving. All right, that name, is rooted in white supremacy, bloody white supremacy itself. We look at Harvard University. Look at how Harvard University was built, and this creates the entry point. These are all things that create entry points to reparations for Native Americans, all right, you know, as well as Black Africans, you know, American born Africans. I mean, you look at Harvard University. Isaac Royal was a sugar plantation owner in the Caribbean, and the building of Harvard's law school is largely based on money from his plantation. You look at the Lehman Brothers. And how, you know, financial institution that fell a few years ago is no more. But that financial institution that was one of the mighty financial institutions for quite some time was built on the plantation money of the Lehman Brothers themselves. These two, you know what I'm saying, two Ashkenazi Jews that came over to the U.S. and to Georgia. And you know, had their plantation down there, and then eventually moved up to New York, and with that money, created, you know, the Lehman Brothers, you know, financial, you know, legacy. These are all things that need to be discussed roundly. I want to bring on, our comrade, Patrick. Patrick, you're on. What are your closing comments that you'd like to...
And I'm going to keep it real short. You guys went around the world. You remember that, going around the world in 80 days?
Yeah.
Y'all went around the world and through history in like 2 hours. And I am so impressed. First of all, I want to give props to you. I want to give props to your guests and everybody that's involved in your program. I'm a 52-year-old Black man, so... I appreciate, and I know I'm younger than you. I know I'm younger than your guests. And what I appreciate is the fact that you guys are delving into this entity that is the world and studying history and doing your homework. I applaud that. What I want to leave you with is this. I just wanted to know, off the cuff, with all the things that have been said, how do you feel, and this is taking a book out of Alice in Wonderland, The Looking Glass, the Black folks that make it through The Looking Glass, the Cosbys, the Oprahs, the rappers, Jay-Z, Beyonce, Lil Wayne, all of them, do they contribute to this, or are they participants in everything that we've talked about? Because we have Black people who are in positions to make things different, that have a voice, they have money, they have a platform. But Tyler Perry, too, I don't see it. What I see you guys doing, I don't see them doing. And I'll take the comments off the air. I just want to keep it short because, you know, I'd rather be long-winded. Don't want to do all that. But I just wanted to put that out there for you guys to see how you feel that black people who have made it, what we call made it, what is their responsibility to embark on this discussion and actually use the forum that they have to put it out there? And I'll listen off the air.
Thank you, Brother Patrick. Thank you. And it's a pleasure to get that kind of praise from an elder. You know, I'm in my 30s, and Sankar is in his 20s, and Tim is in his 20s, and I really appreciate that, you know, coming from an elder, you know, within our community. I really appreciate that, and you know, we'll continue to do the best that we can to carry on the torch and continue to blaze the trail that elders like yourself have set for us. And I want to let folks know that are listening online, we're going to go a little bit longer than intended because Patrick just set us up with that terrific question. So if you're listening online exclusively, what you should do is call in the call-in number, and that way you'll stay on and you'll continue to listen online. Blog Talk, you know, allows us to go a little bit, you know, beyond, but it will cut off. If you're listening online, it will cut off at 6:30 Eastern Standard Time. But if you call in right now at 347-945-5191, that's 347-945-5191, you can continue to listen online, until the show's over. Or you could just, you know, just get offline at 6:30 and then just listen to the rest of the show. When it's archived, and it'll be archived about 5 minutes after it completes itself. Patrick, I'll take a stab at that. I know my comrade, my brother, Sankar, is salivating right now, mentally salivating, is ready to jump in there. I couldn't agree with you more. Listen, I'm going to tell you, answer your question. Hell yeah, they have a responsibility, and hell yeah, they contribute. They are participants in their people's own demise. And they are participants in their own people's demise. And in a way, they've allowed that you know, capitalist apparatus to pollute the good they could be doing right now with the resource. And I'm not even talking about just kind of like, philanthropy, you know, giving money here. I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about using their voice. But yes, you know, the philanthropy could be towards building actual independent institutions of education or even in JC's case and some of these other major rappers, Kanye West, you know, pooling their money and actually creating an institution that is based on resistance-based rap, allowing, you know, rappers that don't want to sell themselves out, that don't want to contribute to the demise of their people by rapping about that coonery, the census, that violence, talking about killing every black and brown men that you come in contact with. And we know that it's the white people that control the airwaves, that control the record labels, you know, the Lior Cohens and the Jimmy Iovines, the folks that only sign, and because we have to understand this, these are white folks that only sign rappers that are willing to accept the cookie cutter mold that they create for themselves, the cookie cutter mold that is the black or brown rapper that is willing to coon around, to, you know, to degrade women, to objectify their own women, that is willing to dance around like a monkey for the ultimate benefit of the white, you know, puppeteers that are controlling them. You know what I'm saying? And at the same time, at the expense of their own people. So Jay-Z and the Kanye, they could put their money, because some of these cats don't know. Right, they're products of the system. You know, they don't know. They don't know, and they haven't been edified. But there are some cats that know. That do know better. You know what I'm saying? And Jay-Z could help towards creating an institution that supported rappers, you know, black and brown rappers to get their music out there, to have their music distributed. You know what I'm saying? When they know that these white corporations, these white labels, are not going to distribute the rappers like it, you know, that are singing, that are rapping songs like the Razzkaa song or Immortal Technique, you know, the music that is in that same vein of the Dead Prezzes and so forth. But beyond that, they could be using their voice to the ill. You know what I'm saying? So we know Oprah Winfrey, she loves, you know, she is an active participant, because someone, she's not going to have somebody like yourself, Patrick, or myself, you know, come on the show, on her show. You know, I've written, you know, 4 books. She's not going to have me come on her book of the month club to talk about my book, you know, Hip Hop Activist Speaks Out on Social Issues. I'm not plugging it. I'm just giving an example, but I'm very proud of that book because I put a lot of time into, you know, and sleepless nights into that book. But she's not going to have, you know, me come on there and talk about a book that is laden, you know, with delving into and breaking down social, you know, myriad social issues and history within that book, and using hip hop as a point of departure. Those folks, you are damn right. You are 100. They contribute. They are active participants in the ongoing demise of their own people. And here's the thing, Patrick, and I'll end on this. The kind of the worst thing about it is I really don't think that they see folks like yourself or myself or folks, you know, that are black and brown, that are suffering right now, that are actually in the streets right now, that are wondering where the next meal is coming from, that are wondering, you know, if they're going to get harassed by the police tonight. I don't think that they see themselves as a part of that community. Those folks, I don't see them think they see themselves. And to give you a point, when Oprah Winfrey, remember a few years ago when Oprah Winfrey gave a whole bunch of money to help build a girls' school in South Africa, and somebody asked her, why didn't you, you know, you live here right in Chicago, you know, and you know what, you know, just said, you know, and I'm not the one to say, so if she gave a different answer, I wouldn't, you know, if she just said, hey, I feel compelled because, you know, I have an affinity towards South Africa, and, you know, it's part of my, you know, ancestral background, you know, being part of the continent of Africa, I would have no problem with that whatsoever, because she's given her money towards an area that is much needed. But it's her response that I have a problem with. So I want to preface everything by saying that, because someone will say, well, what's wrong with giving to the black kids in South Africa? Nothing, nothing. But it's her response, her justification for giving money to black kids in South Africa. So what she said in response to that question, why don't you give, you know, why don't you help build a school in right here in Chicago where your television show at the time was based? And she said, candidly, you know, kids here, they're more interested in sneakers and iPods. You know, they're more interested in sneakers and iPods, and, you know, basically saying they're not going to appreciate the books and this, that, and the other. Well, Oprah, you know what you, all right, let me, Oprah, you know what? Why don't you think outside the box for a second, you nitwit, and say, you know what? I can be a part of that rejuvenation, that education rejuvenation, by building an academy here in Chicago that actually those kids that have been programmed to place more emphasis on, you know, on you know, iPods or sneakers, as you say, then you could be a part of that educational rejuvenation that has always been a part of our community. Has always been a part of our African community here in America, in terms of us providing, you know, schools and institutions of education and learning. As we know, before Brown versus Board of Education, there were around 140 some odd independent black boarding schools throughout the South that had amazing graduation rates and so forth. And so that integration, and I promise here I'm going to end, because Patrick, you did it. You asked a loaded question. But integration only works if the integratee, him or her or they, are able to bring it to go integrate into that society, that larger dominant hegemonic society, with their own cultural mores intact, without having to suppress them or having them being suppressed in any shape, form, or fashion. The integration into America's, you know, white America's public school system came with strings attached. It said you are going to you are not going to learn about your heroes and sheroes. There's not going to be any balanced education whatsoever, any sharing of education and perspectives and narratives and so forth. No. You are going to get the Eurocentric narrative. You are going to get our heroes and sheroes, even when our heroes and sheroes were slave owners. That's what you are going to get. And then, as we know with the Negro Leagues, what did that integration cost us? At the time of the Negro Leagues were the number one employer of black people. It wasn't just baseball players, it was groundskeepers and vendors and so forth. And so these white folks that controlled Major League Baseball at the time, they were only willing to take a Jackie Robinson here and some other folks and some other talented black athletes, you know, and I would say that the Negro Leagues had more talented black baseball players than there were white baseball, talented black, white, you know, baseball players in Major Leagues. They said, yeah, we'll take your best talent because, you know what, help our teams win pennants and World Series and fill our seats, and we fill our pockets and line our pockets with money, 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 more money, more money, more money. But at the same time, they said, we will not allow the owners of these Negro Leagues. We do not allow the black owners of the Negro Leagues, of the Kansas City Monarchs, the Chicago Black Sox. We will not allow them to bring their teams and bring their ownership into Major League Baseball. And so what happened? Several years later, the Negro Leagues were decimated. They disintegrated. No more. Just a memory for us. A memory for us. They were not integration only works if the integratee is allowed to bring in their cultural mores, values, and so forth without it being suppressed. But that is what happened. Our stuff was suppressed, point blank. And you have those rappers and those entertainers right now who are petrified. And I end on this, and I turn it to Sankara. And you are right on track, Patrick. They are more scared of the finance capital coming from their white financiers, coming from the white man, the ones that, you know, they're lining their pockets. They give a damn more about lining their pockets more because there is no end. Doesn't matter whether they have $500 million. Doesn't matter if they have $250 million. Doesn't matter if they have $30 million in the bank. They want more and more and more. And so they do not. Their loyalty is with the white folks who said, yo, we want you to shuck and jive, Negro. We want you to make us happy. We want you to be the comfortable Negro. Don't get outside that box that we built for you. Don't be talking about no social issues. Don't be talking about stop and frisk. Don't be talking about institutional racism. Don't be talking about white supremacy. Don't say any of that stuff. Stay inside this little box. We built you this little box. We built you this little box, black man, black woman. Stay inside that box. Stay inside that box. That's my white person accent. I have a southern one, too. But they say, stay inside that box. And you know what? The likes of Oprah and those folks, they were willing to stay inside that box. That's why I don't extol this modern day, most of these modern day athletes. I don't extol most of them. There are some that have stepped outside and have been willing to take the hit financially to say what's right, like the Chris Douglas Roberts, who spoke out against the war in Afghanistan and then subsequently lost his contract, you know, a sneaker contract. But I extol the likes of Muhammad Ali, who took that hit, who was willing to take that hit, right, against, you know, going and fighting that imperialist, that white man's imperialist war in Vietnam. Sankara.
So, I agree wholeheartedly with, first of all, I'd like to thank you for chiming in and posing that great question. And just to kind of reiterate or, I guess, piggyback off what Solomon was saying, I agree 100% with his assessment of the situation that, you know, that these people, these who are essentially elitists, you know, are willing participants in this dynamic. But at the same time, and this is just my personal opinion, I don't believe that we should look to these people to be our saviors. Because if we look at, you know, historically, you know, know, at any change that's come, you know, within our community, it wasn't, you know, on the backs of, you know, people who are inherently at odds, you know, with our interests because they're working or they're put into place by people who would serve theirs. I mean, example, Barack Obama, but he's not, you know, the only example by any stretch of the imagination. So that said, I think that what we need to do is, you know, really rally behind people who are not going to be at odds, you know, with our interests. People, you know, independent, people who, independent is the key word here. People who are where they're at, independent of any, you know, I guess, or to the best extent possible, I should say, of any help, you know, from people, as I said, who do not have our best interests in mind. Example, you know, people like Solomon and us here at Your World News, who are, you know, doing our best to get this information out there and to have these type of, you know, debates. So, and another point I wanted to add is, I think that we have to keep in mind that this battle is a psychological, you know, game more than it is, you know, physical. So we have, for example, you know, these build out a certain, you know, amount of people who look like us into these positions of power to give the impression or to give that psychological edge of having a brown face in the White House or, you know, a well-spoken talk show host. Because they know that ultimately, you know, it serves their interests. You know, these people are not going to have, you know, raise issues that are really, you know, pressing, you know, whether it be the prison industrial complex or whether it be, you know, neocolonialism, whether it be a domestic or, you know, international issue. These people are not going to, you know, raise that. So, like I said, like we have to understand that this, like I said, is a mind game, and if we approach it as such, you know, then we can start, you know, talking about really deconstructing, you know, this edifice that is white supremacy.
Thank you, Tim. There's some folks that want to hear what you have to say about this. Your closing comments.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to kind of end on some solutions as we like to do on Your World News, and specifically, I want to end on a call to action to white people, European descended people specifically.
And you're the white, you know, so folks, Tim is the white guy speaking, the other guy speaking before was Sankara.
Yes, exactly. It is the obligation of any good-intentioned white person to go into white communities, to go into their communities and organize to end white supremacy there, to end this disease, this infestation, right where it comes from. That is the responsibility of well-intentioned white people. I'm not talking about racist white people. We know where they stand. Screw them. I'm talking about those white people, especially those listening on this show right now that are well-intentioned. If you do not act and speak out and fight white supremacy, then in my mind you are no better than a David Duke, because you are complicit with the white supremacy that continues to go on to this very day. We, and when I say we, I mean Europeans, need to end white supremacy, just like it is men's responsibility to end the misogyny and rape that is so prevalent in the U.S. Women can do all they want to defend themselves, but until men take it upon them to end rape, to end misogyny, it will not end, and that is exactly what white people have to do as well.
Thank you. Appreciate the closing comments, and this has been like a powerful show. This has been one of the most to me, like the most engaging, you know, conversations we've had with folks on the chat room, and sometime, you know, the likes of Kometsu and Patrick, Into Knowledge, you know, and our other guests who have been chiming in, Adam, and so forth. This, you know, and I hope that you guys
Yes, it was. It was. I agree, Patrick. It was very intense. Very intense. And I like they say with good athletes, you know, they go into the, if they're losing a game, you know, or it's crunch time during a game, they go into their huddle in the timeout, and the coach says we have to pick up our intensity. We have to pick our intensity. So we are in intense times. And you're right, Patrick. There are folks right now that are in our community that, because of the distractions, the bells and whistles, the bright, shiny lights, you know, that little babies are, you know, are attracted to, the, you know, the shiny cars and the shiny rims and the reality TV shows and the misogynistic, you know, psychologically destructive rap, it takes their attention away, right? It takes away their attention. It takes their attention away from the intensity of what's really going on. And so, as Malcolm said, it's, you know, when he says you go to that dentist, Malcolm gave that analogy, you go to that dentist and the dentist puts that Novocaine in your mouth and you're numb, you don't feel the pain because you're numb to the, your mouth is going through tremendous damage and it's being damaged, but you don't feel the pain. You don't feel the pain of the damage that's actually going on. And so folks have this media Novocaine that's numbed their minds in terms of what's going on. And so, yeah, it was an intense show. We're in intense times. We have to pick up our intensity, which has to equate to good work, to good, you know, dedicated work that's grounded in love, getting into our communities and each one, you know, teaching not one, but each one teaching 10 or more, as many as we possibly can, and spreading that knowledge, spreading the knowledge of what it takes to build a movement, what it takes to build a community, what it takes to build a community that is completely independent, and then taking the next level and explaining why we must build an independent community, not a community that is attached to Walmart or attached to other corporations or this white person, that white person that only sees dollar signs that is looking forward to having our communities red-lighted so they can gentrify them and move in their little earthy, crunchy, you know, stores and make way for their yuppies. We must create that justification in our own communities why we must build an independent movement, Just like I would say to women, it's important for women to build independent, you know, movements. We can support them as anti-rape, as anti-sexist, anti-misogynistic men. Support them as much as we can, but as Tim said, we go into our communities, our cadres of men, and implore them not to put their hands on women, not to rape women. So sincere white folks like Tim, their work needs to be done in white communities. That is where white supremacy, institutional racism starts. It impacts our communities worse. It causes damage to our communities, but it starts in white communities. That's where that social malady, that sickness, that plague starts. So it's up to folks like Tim to go into his cadres and coteries and communities of white people and to do that work. Not everyone's going to listen to you, Tim. Not everyone's going to listen to you. But you got to make the effort. Even if it's one person here and one person there and three people there and four people there, you got to make that effort. That's where, you know, the bulk of your good work is going to come. And so the intensity is set up. You know, Patrick, appreciate your words. Kometu, thanks for chiming in. Everybody, I see someone just commented on LeBron laying down last night. But, yeah, speaking of LeBron, since you brought LeBron, I don't know if you guys remember, a few years ago, LeBron posed on the cover of that magazine. I think it was like Vogue magazine. He was holding that white model, Giselle. He was holding her in one arm, and he was dribbling the basketball in his other hand, and he was making that growling sound at the camera, and clearly the people wanted him to look like King Kong holding, you know, so they wanted him to look like a big ape, a big ape holding the white damsel in distress, and he's dribbling the ball. If you Google it, type in LeBron James, holding Giselle and Google images, and it will come up, LeBron James looking like ape versus King Kong, because that's what they wanted him to look like, King Kong, and he was willing. Yeah, a friggin' gorilla. Yes, you know what I'm saying? I know, Kometu, you know, yes, like a monkey. But, you know, I just wanted to be technical since, you know, apes are not monkeys. They don't have the prehensile tails. But, yeah, you're right. Looking like the proverbial monkey at the expense of himself and his own community. So I thank everyone for calling in. This has been Your World News. If you want to email us, you can email me directly at solo, S-O-L-O, at yourworldnews.org. That's S-O-L-O at yourworldnews.org. And, you know, any emails that you might have for Sankar or Tim, you can send that way. I'll forward it to them. Unless these gentlemen want to, you know, leave their email addresses. You want to leave your email addresses online, Tim, real quick?
Yeah, definitely. This is Tim speaking right now. If you would like to email me, please contact me at Tim, that's T-I-M dot Baldauf, which is B-A-L-D-A-U-F at gmail.com.
And also, my email is uhurusasa85@gmail.com. That's uhurusasa85@gmail.com. And if we have any international speakers, speakers of Spanish, French, Portuguese, Haitian Creole, Swahili, Lingala, I'm a polyglot, so I mean, I'd be more than willing to, address any question or comment you have, or even just, just build. So that, again, it's ahurusasa85@gmail.com, and we look forward to hearing from you in our next show. And I'll let Solomon have the final word.
And that's that. And my final word is Ubuntu, the Zulu word for I am because you are. We are, and we have to take that approach. Our existence, my existence, is based on, your existence and vice versa. And we have to look at that way. Our success or our demise is based on each other's. And so we must look at that, and we must embrace Ubuntu. We must embrace Ubuntu. I am because you are. And we're just trying to do our little part. We know that we are combating a major entity, a major nefarious entity, as the corporate media will not put these perspectives out there. So I ask you all, once this show is over, go to the site, take the link from this particular radio show, and spread it. Post it on Facebook or send it all to your friends, family, and networks, and implore them to listen in. And so since you said Swahili, I won't say kwaheri, which is goodbye in Swahili. I said utoto nana, which is see you later. We'll see you next week. Same time, same black channel. Not bad channel, same black channel, Your World News. Peace, and this is Malcolm X having the last word.
Africa is a jungle. Yeah. Isn't that what they say? Yeah. That Africans are savage. That Africans are backward. They don't have modern conveniences over there. That's what they tell you. And then they tell you, you're too much like us white folks. What would you do? How would you live if you go back over there? And some of these old dumb, brainwashed, handkerchief-head, 20th century intellectual Negroes, first thing they tell you when you say something about, let's go back home, I haven't lost anything in Africa. No, you lost it all right here. You came over here with it. When you came over here, you had it. But you lost it. You lost your name. You lost your language. You lost your mind. You lost your culture. Don't tell me you didn't lose your mind. You came over here black-minded. Now you're white-minded. Been brainwashed. All of the color has been taken out of your heart and out of your mind. Now you're running around not satisfied unless you can talk like white folks. Unless you can walk like white folks. Unless you can eat and sleep like white folks. You are a white black man, white on the inside and black on the outside. You're not this and you're not that, Mr. In Between. And don't nobody want you, because you don't want yourself. Why, the book says, don't mess with Mr. In Between. Nobody want Mr. In Between. You're a middleman. They won't let you be white and you don't want to be black. You don't want to be an African and you can't be an American. So you run around here like a nut on the law, sitting on the fence. You're in bad shape.